Blog Talk Radio.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Man. He just got done fixing my microphone. Good evening, friends. How is everybody doing? I hope you guys are excited about this show tonight. I have a wonderful guest, Fernando Hernandez. I'm saying that with an English accent. Is that English accent? Anybody who listens to me would say that you have a Spanish accent or a Cuban accent or New Jersey mixed with Minnesota mixed with Spanish. I don't know. But okay, so his name, I'm going to say his name the way Cubans would say it, Fernando Hernandez. He wrote the book, The Cubans, Our Legacy in the United States. And as you know, as I just live my life and you guys live your lives, and we are all here in America now. You know, many people in the United States think that when foreigners arrive here, we should, it's almost like we should take off our identity clothes. What is it, Mr. Man? Do you understand what I'm saying? Your ancestors came here, what was it, grandma? Grandma was little? Your grandma was little, Mr. Man? Mr. Man, are you listening? I don't think he's even listening. Can you hear me? Hello, Mr. Man? Are you listening to the show? You are? How come you're not? I'm talking to you. Did you hear what I said? Okay, just make sure that this is why make sure the sound. You're fired. The show didn't even start and he's gone. Oh, you are delayed. Okay, sorry. So okay, we'll keep you on. I was asking about your relatives when they came here, you know, how it is in America. Most people think that we should take off our identity clothes because we come with an identity. We come already with a, is the sound okay? We come already with formed, characters, opinions, personalities. But for some reason, people think that once you arrive here, we forget everything and we just become Americans, Americanized. You're in the United States 24 hours. You're an American now. Forget who you are. Forget your and all the people that you leave behind. So as I was looking at this book, I know that there's probably people who have been born here. And they might go to the library or a bookstore and see it. And Lola agrees with me. She's my husky, and she is all American. And she says, yes, Kumana, yes, Mommy. And they might think, what the heck is this thing here at the library? Why do people need to remember where they come from? Why can't they just, you know, be happy with the freedom they have here? Otherwise, why do they come to the United States if it isn't because they didn't like it so much where they were? Why do they have to think about who they are here? Well, you know what? Everybody has, not only do we like to remember, but we are proud to remember. And I think that if you are born here and for generations you don't understand what that is like because you're not in those shoes. But for anybody who is an immigrant, whether you are, Mexican, Peruvian, Venezuelan, Irish, Australian, wherever you come from, you have family, you have ties, you have things that you either remember or stories that have been told to you. And they really mean a lot. For some reason, as we go about our lives, there may be things in our personalities or things that we like or things that attract us, and we have no clue why we are attracted to a certain style of, let's say, architecture or music or food or clothing. And as we investigate who we are, often it seems to me that there's some kind of a genetic code or a genetic memory, even though you may not have lived it. I'm not a psychiatrist or I don't play one on TV, but I'm just saying I know for my own personal experience, even though I lived in Cuba for 10 years, there's a lot of things that I experienced and a lot of things that I did not. But as I have gone living my life, there has been things that I have been so attracted to, and I say to myself, why the heck do I like this? That's not even Cuban. And as I have investigated more, I find that, yeah, indeed, there's certain things that have had Cuban roots, and it just blows my mind. So I think that it's wonderful to remember who we are. I know in this country, Black Americans, or I don't know what is the. Do not call me here at the show and say, Cubana, you're not saying it right, or I'm not being politically correct, because Cuban blacks are that, Cuban blacks, and whether they're blacks or brown or whatever, they're from Africa, and we love them, and they don't have an issue with what we say and how we call them. They're just, it is what it is, but blacks enjoy remembering and they're very, very proud of their African roots, and so are we. The Cubans have adopted a lot of their parts of their religion and music, and as you will see, our wonderful guest this evening, Fernando Hernandez. He is a professor in Florida, and he's going to talk to us about the book, "The Cubans: Our Legacy in the United States." Why is it important for all of us to remember where we come from, even though we're here in America, the melting pot of the world? And good evening to you, Fernando Hernandez. How are you doing?
Good evening, Cubana. Thank you so much for the invitation, and good evening to your listening audience.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm glad that you accepted. I'm so glad that you wrote this book. Now that we have the internet, and a lot of people can do a lot of research, but it's really nice to have something concrete and something that you can go to, a book that you can go to and find a lot of information about your, a person's heritage, in this case, the Cubans. Tell me a little bit about yourself before we get into the book and the people in it and why you wrote it and all of that. Tell me a little bit about yourself. When did you come to the United States? What year did you move to the United States? Did you come with your family, or did you come already as an adult?
I came in 1962 when I was 9 years old. My brother and I were part of the Operation Pedro Pan organization that spirited over 14,000 young boys and girls from Cuba to the United States between 1960 and 1962. Pedro Pan operation was orchestrated by the Catholic Church. And my brother and I, we arrived here, as I mentioned, in 1962. We lived in Miami for about 7 months. We were supposed to go to a boys' camp, but we had a cousin who was living here at that time in Miami, and she actually picked us up at the airport and took us home with her. And so we lucked out in terms that we had a family that took us in. So we lived here for about 7 months. Then after that, a maternal aunt, she lived in New York City. She had been living in New York for many, many years with her husband. And she sent for us, and we got on a plane, came up to New York, and she was our beloved second mother. And we were reunited with our parents more or less about 4 years later.
Wow.
So that's my initial stay in the United States.
So you were 9 years old, and then when you saw your parents again, you were about 13?
13, yes.
Okay. Did you feel that in those 4 years, of course, did you speak English by then?
Well, that's a good question. Now, when I arrived here, I didn't know, as we say, a lick of English. But that's a very interesting question, Kuhana, because just the other day I was talking to somebody, and I was relating to this person that I do not remember the process of learning English. Now, wow. This may sound weird, but I don't understand. I don't remember actually the process of learning English. It was as if it was slowly, I was immersed in English. There was no bilingual education. There was no ESOL classes. It was like swim or sink, right?
Right.
So I learned English right off the bat and quickly I learned English. And
wow.
It was just an amazing phase in my life and for my brother as well that we came here, we learned English, and we just kept rolling along.
And as you say, you know, I'm thinking about myself, how it was for me. So the process, I was 10 years old when I moved here. So you and I were about the same age.
Right.
And you say you didn't have a special ed class that taught you the ABCs or anything like that?
None whatsoever.
We did. My brother and I had about 45 minutes in the morning with a wonderful teacher. And I know I grew up in Jersey, so in Union City. So a lot of my friends from Union City, if you know, and I think she was in a Jersey City school, public school. Her name was Mrs. Flanagan, and I will never, ever forget her. She was a wonderful teacher. She fed my brother and I breakfast every morning, even though we had breakfast at home. But she must have thought that maybe, now I realize, she must have thought we were hungry. But she gave us like a donut and a little milk every single morning. She gave us that. And so, like I said, I'll never forget her. But I do remember the process. She used to put in front of us the ABCs, and you know, and she expected us to follow and repeat after her. And I had absolutely no clue what she was doing. She was saying A, B, C, and we were going A, B, C. My brother picked up faster than I did, and I was thinking that she was wrong because no one explained to me what we were doing. I had no clue. I was pretty smart when I was in school in Cuba, and I had more of a fifth grade, sixth grade level of my work, but when I came to the United States, things started to slide back. Did you find, you say now you learned English, it was like sink or swim. It took me a long, long time. I have to say it took me a lot of years to really grasp comprehension, being able to read, being able to understand, and then put to practice what I was, you know, directions and things like that. When you think back, how was it for you the first year, the second year, the third year in school? Did you go from grade to grade to grade up and continue to move on, getting good grades? How was that process? And the reason why I ask you this is because as people are listening, I think it's important for people to understand the process. I've never done this before. But when I used to teach foreigners English as a second language, my heart just went out to them because I understood because of my own experience, but so many people do not. So for you, and today you're a professor, how cool is that? But how was that process for you the first, second, third year as you try to go back and recall?
Well, I remember that when we went to live in New York City, we arrived there, I believe it was in March of 63, and I was put right into, I think it was fourth grade. So it was a Catholic school, elementary school, and it was a wonderful situation because it was a very good mix of Irish Americans, Black Americans, and Hispanics. My best friends were basically Puerto Rican Americans or Puerto Ricans, along with the Blacks and the Irish. Mm-hmm. And I remember that they really helped me a great deal when I didn't understand a particular word. I would ask a couple of my Puerto Rican friends, how do you say this in English? And they would think, and they would say, you say this in English, right? Stuff like that. And that's how I learned. And to be honest with you, after maybe 3 or 4 years, my English was better than some of the native-born here in the United States. I really like English as a language.
Yes.
And I picked up on English and poetry and the whole bit, and actually I love the English language.
You know, I do too. I was really, really good at spelling, but when it came to like reading history, I had a really difficult time. And I always thought that I never liked history or I didn't like science. But the reason for that is because I really didn't understand. I probably understand a fourth of what I was reading. So it was difficult for me. But as we integrate, because that's what children do, we integrate into society. So even if it's difficult, it's easier for us than it is for an adult who moves to the United States. When your parents arrived, how was that? How did that change your life? Did you feel like you went back another 4 years trying to explain to mom and dad the things that you were learning? Were your parents open to you guys speaking English in the home? How was that process for your parents? Was it easy or was it difficult? Or how did they adjust?
You know, one of the things that when one is separated from one's parent at an early age, like mm-hmm. like in our case, for example, you have a different perception of your parents. I grew up very close to my father in Cuba. He would work, and he would come home, for example, for lunch, and I would walk from school home also for lunch, and would have lunch, then would take a nap and would wrestle in bed. So we had this very close relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Those 4 years really changed a great deal. After my father, my mother came, it wasn't the same, you know, that to this day I regret the fact that communism took over in Cuba
mm-hmm.
because the separation of the family just has taken a tremendous toll. And it got to the point, you know, where we grew up in the United States and we look at our parents. My parents had a sixth grade education level. That's it. And here we are, you know, going to college, et cetera, and we have this this feeling, this sensation, perhaps unfounded, that we are better than our parents because we are more Americans and we have more education. And here are a couple of sixth graders, education folks, who came to this country, who started working, who learned to take the subway in New York City, navigate everything, trying to give us a better life. Let me tell you, it's a funny story, that my mom, she was always a go-getter. She was really... First day she got here, within 1 week, she was already working in downtown Manhattan as a seamstress. Now, she was trying to learn some English. And one day she got home and she said, Fernand, you know, I got in the subway today and, you know, I don't know what's wrong with people. They would give me this odd look. They were, like, really looking at me kind of funny.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Mommy, what did you say? And she said, you know, I was trying to get from one car to the next car. And it was very crowded. And I kept telling the people, squeeze me, squeeze me. And then I said, Mommy, the right word is excuse me. And she kept saying, squeeze me, squeeze me. And people were obviously like, who is this lady, right? So it is a funny story, but it is a true story. But she didn't care. She munched forward, you know.
That is funny. But, you know, the funnier thing is that the people, didn't anybody understand what she was saying? Because if I would have listened to that, I would have explained, I would have told her, even if I was just English speaking, I would have said, excuse me, to try to teach her what it was. But see, I'm that kind of a person that I just try to help. But people, I don't understand why people, that's the thing about foreigners, and I know that a lot of Americans, foreigners get really hurt when they realize they're really trying hard, and some people here act like, what are you talking, and they don't really pay attention to them. It's very cold. Luckily, I think that the nation is changing, that people are a little bit more warm to foreigners, and that they try to be helpful. But, you know, we have seen some shows on 2020 where somebody, and I can't remember right now who was the host of that particular show, where they showed people who are not of this culture who needed help, and you know, people just brushing them off. And I think it's so hard. But in your mom's case, that is a funny story. And she must have just laughed. She must have just thought, boy, am I glad nobody did squeeze me.
Yeah, that's she was, you know, she did what she had to do to go to work, you know, to raise us along with my father. They were very humble people, and my brother and I were so thankful that they took that decision to send us to the United States, you know, and they stayed behind. I did not realize how hard it must have been for them to be separated from us. Now, this what I'm about to tell you is really is very touching, because we never said a goodbye to our father when we left Cuba. My father was so heartbroken that he did not have the nerve to say goodbye to us. He stayed, you know, with my grandmother. And my mother was the one that actually had to take us all the way from our hometown in Banes, get on a long bus ride to Havana, spend a few days there. All that time, my mother had a big smile on her face until we left.
I don't know how she did it either. I don't know how she did
it. It was very tough. It was very tough.
I don't know if I would be able to do it, but I can't even put myself in that position. Just
well,
the thought of it is so hard. So hard.
I say this, I think the same way as you do, Kuwana, because I have two children. Now they're adults, but when they were growing up, it's like I said, could I ever do what my parents did?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very tough call for me, because when my kids were small, I made sure that every opportunity that I had, we always went out together as a family, something that I never did as a young boy. So I undid what was not possible for me when I was a young boy with them, you know? So it's a very emotional thing for me to talk about, but it's part of my history.
Yes, and you know, I know a lot of Peter Pan babies, as I call them, Peter Pan babies, because it doesn't matter if a person or a child was 12 or 14 or 9 or 2, I think that they were all babies. The way that we grew up in Cuba is so different than the way kids grow up in the United States. And sometimes I think that is the reason why I, even though I am an adult, I am still naive about a lot of things, even when I am faced with the truth and with reality. Because I grew up in such a household that, I mean, I believed in Santa Claus, almost, not Santa Claus, but the Three Magic Kings, almost up until, you know, I think I was like 8 or 9 years old. And to try and keep that from a kid, even when you're living under communism, it's pretty hard. I believed in La Cigüeña. I don't even know how to say that.
Oh, La Cigüeña, that's a stork.
I believed in the stork. I think my sister was born when I was 8, and a neighbor girl told me, she said, you know, because I kept saying, the stork brought me a sister, and she's like, the stork didn't bring you a sister, it was your mom had a baby. And I said, no, my mom didn't have the baby. And she told me how it was done, and I was shocked, I didn't want to hear it, I started crying, and I told my mom. My mom was so mad. But, you know, this is how I I've tried to do, you know, to open up my daughters. I have a 13-year-old. I have tried to give my daughter a balance, a sense of, you know, being able to be aware about herself and surroundings, but at the same time keeping her in her own, you know, keeping a little bit of that innocence, because I think when we lose innocence, it just makes us a little bit more cynical about everything. And remembering our heritage is so important. The things that we did, the things, you know, family. I wanted to ask you, because I know I did a little bit of research in I read a lot of your book. I didn't read all of your book, but I read a lot of your book. And I also did a little bit of research about the exodus of Cubans into the United States. And I found, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's probably about a good four pretty big moments in time that Cubans left Cuba. The Bay of Pigs in 59, Freedom Flights with, now I realize, Camarioca was the Peter Pan babies, right?
No. Camarioca was after Operation Pedro Paz between 1960 and 1962.
Okay.
So that was only a 2-year span. Camarioca was after. And then there were all, after that, there was like different stages of exodus, right? That we have the rafters, Los Balseros.
Yes.
And you had the folks going into Guantanamo Bay, right? And they were allowed to come in. So it's been very gradual to the point now that the visa system that allows an organized exodus from Cuba of up to 20,000 people per year can legally or organized manner come to the United States. So it's been ongoing. But let me tell you, Cubana, that Cuba was a nation before 1959 that received immigrants. And people really did not leave Cuba very much at all. Some obviously did, but Cuba had received a great deal of immigrants in the 30s, 40s, and 50s because it was that ideal of a place to live and start and start a business and start a new family, etc.
Yes, you know what I heard once, and you correct me again if I'm wrong, but I think this is correct. The very first university ever in the world, was that in Havana?
In the world? No. I think the first university, I'm pretty sure about this, in Latin America was in the Dominican Republic, but not in the world. Because the old world, Europe, was much older than, and they had their universities there. But I believe in Hispanic America was in Dominican Republic.
What about, do you know when was the first university built in Cuba? Was it in the 1800s? I thought it was in the 1800s.
It could have been in the 1800s. The University of Havana is probably the oldest university there.
Okay.
The exact date, I could not vouch for that, though.
Yeah, I'm going to look into that because I can't remember who told me. It was maybe not the world. As you said, you know more. You're a lot smarter than I am.
Oh, don't stretch it.
So, oh my goodness. So here you are. Your mom and your father are working. And I know it has to be difficult because so many of our parents, in Cuba, there is a lot of wealthy people. But there was also your everyday folks who had just the blue-collar workers, electricians and plumbers and you name it. And these guys came to the United States, and they had to find a new way. I don't even know how they did it, Fernando, because if I had to leave the United States now, I speak two languages, but if I had to go to Italy and of course Italian, I think that we can understand a little bit of Italian, but English was so different from Spanish. To learn another language, I can't even imagine how.
But, when you have, like in our case, when you have two young boys that you have to raise, and you come to a new country, the first thing that I recognize is that my parents, first of all, they were so grateful that we were able to be reunited. That was number one to them, that they were so grateful. They never complained about anything in the United States. They never, said that taxes are too high, I don't make enough money,
right?
Inflation. They never said one negative thing about living in the United States, which now that I look back, I said, how grateful were they, To give you an idea, my dad, he when he arrived here, again, sixth grade education, his job was a dishwasher in the downtown athletic club in New York City. That's where they give the Heisman Award trophy every year for college football. So my dad worked there in the dishwashing department. My mom was a seamstress, a profession that she always did since she was like 9 or 10 years old in Cuba. She loved to make dresses. So when she got to New York City, she started working in factories. And then, I'm very proud to say, she was so good at it that eventually she landed a job at the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts in Manhattan, making and fixing dresses for the opera in that place.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah. And most of the ladies there were from Eastern Europe, and she was one of the very few Latinas that actually was, you know, able to work there, making dresses for, you know, opera and stuff like that.
That is awesome. Now, I know, living in Minnesota since I was 16 years old, and when I first moved here, there was barely any Spanish, especially Cubans. There was just a few. I mean, I can count in one hand how many Spanish people I knew, including my family, and maybe two hands, including my family. But to have, for people who are in a place where there are no Spanish, no Cuban, to have a book like this and to read, especially about their own culture, and realize that Cubans have been in the United States for a long, long time, and some of these folks in the book are amazing because, as you say, here your mom was able to accomplish something that, you know, how many American-born ladies may have wanted to do what your mom did. But here your mom landed that job. But how many folks in this book came where it seemed like, you know, they were just your regular folk and then ended up doing something amazing with their lives? And I think this is what I like about your book, is that it gives people hope. It gives us, not just Cubans, but I think as I was reading it, I was thinking, if Cubans can do it, anybody can do it, because what makes us so special?
Right. We are, you know, I'm a firm believer that Cuban Americans, we're not any better. We're not superior human beings. But I think the mental process has a lot to do with our success, because you have to be motivated. Mm-hmm. You have to be focused in marching ahead, overcoming obstacles, and succeeding in life. And I think that we Cubans and Cuban Americans, we have this drive to succeed. And I think most of it is derived from the fact that in 1959, Cuba was ranked as the third leading nation among all Hispanic nations in the Western Hemisphere. There were only two countries ahead of Cuba in terms of economic growth, in terms of education, in terms of health, social laws, social benefits, et cetera, et cetera. So Cuba was actually, aside from the fact of all the corruption, whatever you want to say about poor governments, et cetera, the Cuban people as a whole lived quite well, mm-hmm. and the standard of living in Cuba was quite good. So this type of mentality enabled us, when we came to the United States, to just, we can say, pick up the pieces and move ahead and succeed here as well.
Right. I remember I think the first couple of years, I mean, I remember as far back as being, and people are surprised when I tell them, I remember sitting on a high chair. I remember eating compotas, you know.
Baby food.
I remember not being able to hold my spine up because I didn't have control of my body. Being a baby, sitting at, my father used to work at a store right in Havana called Washington, and it was a clothing store for men. They sold suits, very beautiful suits. I don't know where they were made. I would assume they were made in the United States. The store was called Washington. And I remember my dad, my mom brought me to see my dad at work one day, and they were around me, but they had put me on the glass counter, and I could see the glass, through the glass, I could see the items, you know, like the ties and things that were inside. And I remember not understanding why I wasn't falling through, though I could feel and I could see, I could just close my eyes and see my little hand with the little wrinkles and touching the glass and going from the left to the right, kind of bobbing, and I'm thinking, I was scared, but I wasn't crying, you know. So there's little things like that I remember about Cuba. I remember picking up a bottle of Coca-Cola that was totally empty. It was in the back, it was way in the back in the patio where they had a big closet with locks, and I don't know how I opened it, and I took this bottle and I tried to drink out of it, and there were cockroaches in it.
And oh my gosh.
Yes, and my mom, of course, they didn't go in my mouth because I closed my mouth, but I was little, and my mom screamed, and she took a rag and started cleaning my mouth. And but I remember seeing that bottle of Coca-Cola, and that marked so many memories for me about the United States. Like, why don't we have Coca-Cola? As I was getting older, and I remembered, you know, I remember that bottle and of Coca-Cola, and because they continued to tell the story over and over, and so I knew it was a bottle, and I could still see them. You know, that we still had them. We had a lot of magazines, Popular Mechanics. We had Reader's Digest. And so there were a big collection of different things that my father was very much into radio. He fixed radios as well. He had a degree in electricity or whatever you call it, electronics. So, you know, my family was very, you know, we were living our lives to the fullest. Like you said, Cubans were really, really involved in our lives. Were not, as you said, they were not that bad. It was family oriented. Everybody, it was like family was everything. And but the regime, what is it? Because people don't understand it when we say, well, you know, Cuba was great, but we didn't have food and we didn't have this. And why did we come here? Why is it that Cubans want to leave the island?
Well, I can only speak for my situation. My parents, they saw a system that was a dictatorship, first of all, a godless ideology, and a system that they were sure we as their sons were going to lose us to a system that the mm-hmm. party came first and family didn't have much meaning. And I have a vivid memory that until the day that I die, it will never be erased from my mind. I remember walking in my hometown. I must have been maybe 7 or 8 years old. And I saw this elderly man with white hair. He was having a discussion with a Fidelista, one of these soldiers, a Fidel supporter, obviously, with his machine gun and the long hair and the beard, the whole bit. And I remember that I stood there, and the old guy asked this young rebel, he asked him, well, tell me, why is it that you folks do not believe in God? And the young soldier, he hoisted his rifle mm-hmm. into the air, and he said the following: this is the only God we believe in. And he started laughing, and the old man put his head down, he was dejected, and he walked away. I have never forgotten that. So when you have a system where God, to them, is a machine gun, it's a gun, it's material, it's the party, it's Fidel, you lose your moral values, you lose the standards for which normal society abides by it, living under communism.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the United States moving somewhat in a similar direction nowadays, with people not wanting to separate, you know, God and state, and so many things that are separated in schools that I don't know what we're teaching, if we're just teaching academics, but I know I spent a lot of years in school teaching, observing, volunteering. And I just don't see the same dedication to really teach children morals. I think that we're teaching them what's on the books, and you know, I don't know. Do you see any similarities in our world today?
What I see is a very definite trend towards a secular system, where politicians want to be so politically correct that they would rather have a situation where God, the word God, is not even mentioned. Now, let me preface this by saying that in politics, I am a registered independent. Okay, I'm a registered independent. But to me, I found it to be very strange, and it really bothered me when the Democratic National Convention was held, that they actually had to take a vote to allow the word or to use the word God during their convention. To me, I could not believe that was happening in the United States, that a major political party had actually had to have a discussion and a vote. Do we allow this word called God? Can we use this during our convention? To me, and again, I'm independent, it doesn't bode well for a country when you have to go to that level of discussion. And the other thing that I see this movement, for example, during Christmas, some of these stores, some of these retail giants, they may sell holiday trees instead of Christmas trees because they don't want to insult, oh my gosh, to insult somebody by saying Christmas tree, you know. So I'm bothered by that. I think we're a spiritual nation, respecting everybody's, you know, religious viewpoints. But I think we have to be a little bit more serious and realize there is a greater power above us that we should, you know, honor and we should recognize, you know. We can't go the secular route because pretty soon everything is going to be materialism in the United States.
Well,
that's my opinion.
I remember in Cuba, and it was instilled in my head since I was a little child, that for some reason I always heard, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You know, so I always, and Americans tend to do that, wherever the politicians go, they try to be very polite and not to insult. You know, for example, in Japan or China, they try to find out what their, you know, what things are in their culture that, that, you know, that they might do that would insult them. So why is it that when we are here in our own country, we don't, I'm not saying demand people to respect, but how about if we just respect ourselves? Because you can't demand respect if you don't respect yourself, and who's going to respect you? In our culture, I find that, you know, every time I hear this happy holidays, I say Merry Christmas. And people around me look like, and you're correct, some people are so afraid to insult people. I have friends who are Muslims, and I say Merry Christmas to them, and they say Merry Christmas to me, even though they don't celebrate it.
Exactly.
So I don't know what the big deal is. I think the politicians are enjoying dividing and conquering. I think they're making such a big deal out of things because my friends that know me and know me well, we can have discussions about these things and what different parties are doing, and we agree on some things, we disagree on other things. But I think what's really upsetting is when you have a mass of people who want to say that independents or conservatives are wrong in our thinking because we don't want to see, you know, America going down the drains. We see so many people are losing their homes, losing jobs, kids are getting out of school, not finding any work. And so we as Cuban people have lived such difficult times, and we understand the process that a country takes when it's going down. When that ship is sinking, we know the signs, and we're trying to tell people, listen, this is happening. Why don't you look? You're losing your rights. You're losing your freedom, and this is what's going to happen next. Why is it that Americans in this country, and even a lot of Spanish people who may have come here for freedom, don't see the movement in, it's going in the wrong direction, but how come they don't see that? And they think it's wonderful. They think that the movement is great.
Well, I think that some people get spoiled, and they get complacent, and which is a bad thing to do for any country and its population, to become complacent. And, you know, right now in the United States, the biggest employer is the United States government. So when the biggest employer is the government, a lot of people depend on that employer. So they don't want to do anything to get the employer upset. So if the employer says go this way, go that way, right? So the employer, the biggest employer right now in the United States is the United States government. The biggest private employer is Walmart. So we have two extremes here. So people should not be complacent and really look for the look at the long-term consequences.
Exactly.
I'm not a politician, okay, but look at long-term consequences.
I'm not either, I just want people to understand it. I'm sure there's wonderful Democrats. I don't want to jump on all of them, because there's wonderful Democrats, just as there's awful Republicans, and it's just really what they vote for, how they're voting, and how they stand for the people. I just think small government is better all the way around, because when we came to the United States, most foreigners, they came for the opportunity. We were never guaranteed anything in our own countries, let alone we come here and now we want to have the guarantee that we're going to have a cell phone, or we're going to have a big TV, or we're going to have our own big home. And it's like we have forgotten that the reason why we came here was to work hard and make these things happen for ourselves. In the process, it takes a little bit of sacrifice. I remember hearing that word all my life. My mother always said, you have to sacrifice, you have to sacrifice. I heard it so much, I don't want to hear it anymore. It's like, I'm sacrificing. But it is, if you look at it as a negative thing, then it is. But if you look at it as a process of learning, growing, and becoming better than the way that you came, then you are truly a survivor. I think it is pitiful when we come here and then we become complacent and we expect the government to raise taxes to no end, and we know that that is not really going to happen. What's going to happen, we're going to lose all of the middle class, all those folks that have worked really hard to have that small company. They're the ones that are going to be going away. And those big companies, they're getting the freebies because they're not paying taxes. And it doesn't matter what the president says or anybody does. We know GE, didn't pay any taxes. And that's going to be the trend. Or these big companies are going to go outside of the United States. There isn't a product that you can buy today that doesn't say made in China or made in, somewhere else. Very few things are made in the United States. And when I look at them, and I was talking about that with Mr. Mann the other day, I said, why don't we make more things here? And he says, well, would you want to pay more money for these items? And no, because I'm always looking for a good deal when I go to the store. So in a way, we've done it to ourselves. We buy foreign-made products, and some of them are great, some of them are not so great, but we're looking for that next best deal. And but overall, I think that that we just have to work hard and try to be entrepreneurial, and which is, by the way, a lot of the folks that you talk about in your book, the Cubans, our legacy in the United States. You mentioned quite a few of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's start with, because we talked about your family. We talked a little bit of background there on Cuba. We talked a little bit about politics. So you folks kind of get the idea of where, everything has a beginning, right? And now we come to the middle. Why are these folks here in the United States looking for freedom, looking for a better way to live our lives? And this country, I believe that the sky is the limit, don't you?
Oh, definitely. This is why you see people getting on boats and rafts coming to the United States, and you don't see that, leaving, right? Because this is definitely the land of opportunity of folks from all over the world who want to have a fresh start, who want to have freedom and move forward. This is still the land of opportunity. I agree.
Absolutely. I was looking in the first chapter. You have an artist and entertainers. You have a lady by the name of Mijdia. Let me know if I'm saying it wrong. Mijdia Chinea Varela.
Chinea, yeah.
Yeah, Varela.
Mijdia Chinea Varela, oh. Yeah. She's out there in California. And
I found her very interesting. Tell us about her, because I don't think anybody knows this stuff. This is really cool. Who was she?
You threw me a curve there, because I have selected a few people that I have my notes here.
That's
so
perfect.
I'm just being honest with you. I would have to go through
the entire
book here, and it would throw me off.
No.
I'm not skirting the issue. I'm just saying
I
have this thing organized.
Oh, no, sorry. She is on page 12. Let me see. Hang on a second here. Just a moment here. I believe she's... Yeah.
Oh,
I
found her on page 12, yep. Yes.
She's on page
12. She's a very interesting lady because, you know, she has been a writer for TV series The Incredible Hulk and Superboy. And she's very active there in L.A. in different TV and movie roles. For us, as Cuban-Americans, we're very proud because... Migdia Chinea Varela, she was the first Latina to join the Writers Guild of America West, and she founded its Latino Writers Committee. So she's a tough cookie because she has spoken out against discrimination in the United States entertainment industry, and she has testified before Congress and the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So she's there, you know, fighting for more Latinos to have a better entry into the entertainment business in the United States. So that's one person that a lot of people do not know, that she's very active in L.A. and she happens to be a Cuban American.
I know, and I'm going to give you a chance to tell me about the folks that you have selected. But
mm-hmm.
I also selected some, and I know what pages they're on, so you could take a peek at them.
Okay.
Right below her, there is, and this name, the reason why I chose some of these is because they're interesting. Others, their names don't even, you know, it's not like Ricky Ricardo, you know. A name that you go, oh, that's a Spanish name. Baru, you can tell Salinas, you have no idea. Baru, where does that name come from?
Yeah.
Salinas.
Well, Baruch Salinas, he is a Cuban of Jewish background.
Mm-hmm.
Baruch is a very Jewish name. And Salinas, that's his last name, obviously. Now, Baruch, he's a professor here in Miami at Miami-Dade College. And he's a world-renowned painter. And according to Conservapedia, his works are on display in all kinds of galleries in Europe, United States. For example, the Art Institute of Chicago and the Museum of Art in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He has won numerous prizes, including the Prize to Excellency at the Grand Prix International de Pintura in Cannes, and he won a first prize at the 4th Pan American Exhibition in Miami, and a first prize at the 6th Bienal del Grabado Latinoamericano in San Juan, Puerto Rico. So he's a very well-known artist. He's actually a painter that most people are unaware of his existence, and
right.
He happens to be a Cuban Jew, or as we affectionately call him, Jubens.
Jubens.
Yes.
You know, Jubens. I never realized.
They call that name up among themselves. It is not the derogatory. It is not effective at all. It is just an affectionate name, a Juben. It's
very
a cute
sweet. I never knew that there was that many Jews in Cuba until somebody pointed it out. I think the last 2 years I learned about that. The last 2 years. Since I started.
In Cuba, Cubana, by the late 1950s, there were about 15,000 Cuban Jews.
Wow.
The majority were based in Havana. Right now in Cuba, there's an estimation of maybe 1,200 Jews left in Cuba. Over 90% left the island after 1959.
Can you believe it? What they went through and now this?
Yeah. It happened to the Jews. Many of them immigrated to Cuba because of the Holocaust. Then they had to take a hike after communism took over. The same thing happened to those Cubans of Chinese background. Many Chinese immigrated to Cuba because of the communism
right.
uprising in China. They went to Cuba. Then years later, they had to pick up everything and leave Cuba and come to the United States.
I know. People don't realize. I remember a lot of Chinese in Cuba. Another interesting lady here, Terce Vandenberg. She's on page 14.
Yes,
there.
Yes.
Georgia.
Terce is a very, she's a good friend of mine. I haven't met her personally, but, you know, through technology, Facebook, et cetera. She's a wonderful lady. Terce lives in Tucker, Georgia. And she is a storyteller. Now, she's the type of person that she loves to tell stories in English and Spanish. Now, she got into this as a hobby, and then one day she went to a school system, and she asked the principal or the person in charge, can you let me, you know, do a story here? Can I relate a story to the children? And if you like what I do, all I want is a letter of recommendation. She did her story. She did her tale. They loved her. And she has received, after that, many, many offers. And she's a freelance storyteller. And she performs with what is known as the Young Audiences, which is an organization in schools throughout Georgia and all over the United States as well. What she does is that, Tercy, she offers Latin American folktales. Mm-hmm. And she incorporates also stories native to, for example, Georgia. And she's able to do it in English and Spanish. So she's like a cultural bridge. Here we have a person like Tercy Vandenberg, who is reaching out to young people, elementary school children, with her talent of storytelling, and she travels throughout the southern United States. So she's a wonderful inspiration to many people who may feel that the art of storytelling has been lost. It's alive and well with Tercy.
That's wonderful. I would love to interview her if you can make that possible. And I
definitely.
I love stories. That is one of the things that I miss so much about the Cuban culture, because I remember every single evening my mom and my grandma used to go across the street and sit with a neighbor. Her name was Elisa, and she lived with her brother who was, they called him El Mudo, because he was mute and he couldn't hear. And I remember he didn't even know sign language, but somehow he communicated with his sister. And Elisa's home, I remember she had a huge avocado tree in the back of her home, and she had a big balcony where the kids used to sit, or the adults would sit. The kids would watch TV. Either way, sometimes the older folks' moms were out. But they were always watching us, and they would tell stories all night long, you know, until like, you know, 11, 12 o'clock at night, and the stars would be out and the moon would be out, and I remember just listening to stories. Sometimes the movie was over, but the kids used to play jockeys, and the boys used to run around, and you know, it was such a neat. The family, the friends, the neighbors. It was such a, and the stories. I miss that, and I know she would definitely bring that back to the audience, our listeners, and for folks around America that don't know what that's like, that have never experienced it, never tasted it. It would be amazing to see and to hear. David Lebatard, is it Lebatard on the same page?
Yes, Lebatard.
Okay.
There are two brothers. There's another Lebatard brother who's very well known as a sports writer, and he has a show on, I believe it's like ESPN, where he does sports programming. But this brother right here, David Lebatard, he is an artist, and he has an artist name. He's known professionally as Lebo. And basically, he is, and I'm quoting here, he is a self-proclaimed postmodern cartoon expressionism. That's his bag, right? He likes to do that. So it's basically the application of cartoon imagery combined with richly saturated balances of color and unique linear composition. Now, I'm not into art because that's not my thing, but he's very well known. He was born in New York City of Cuban parents, and he started going into the arts world. Basically, he had his first exhibition in 1996 here at Johnson & Wales University. And after that, he's got gallery exhibitions in Detroit, L.A., New Orleans, South Africa, Germany, Italy. He won a prize, actually, in 2003. He created the official artwork of the Latin Grammy Awards, which is, you know, the world's premier Latin music award ceremony. So he actually created that. And he's also, his collection is all over corporations such as Bacardi, Latin Grammy, San Francisco Century Investment, et cetera, et cetera. So he's an not been coming. He's already a well-established artist, and his brother's name is actually Daniel. Daniel Le Batard, he's the well-known sports writer.
That is so wonderful. I have to say, I want to thank my good friend, Prince Emmanuel. I'm not going to mush up his last name here. Adirelli, Emmanuel Adirelli. He is a prince from Nigeria. He's a good friend who lives in Florida, in Miami, near Miami, not right in Miami. He has been a guest on my show quite a few times, and he's also an artist. He's a musician, a wonderful musician. He is listening to the show right now, and he's in the chat room saying, I am really enjoying this conversation, and I know that he would, especially with all the artists and painters, as you're pointing out, and Prince Emmanuel is a wonderful painter. Prince Emmanuel, why don't you go ahead and point or type on there, where do you have an exhibition right now, anything going on with you right now that you want us to say on the air, and as I continue with the interview with Professor Fernando Hernandez, will go ahead and announce and let our friends know what's going on with you as well. And I want to say hello to Bob Cornish, one of our wonderful friends, followers. A lot of people that may be listening, but they're not logged in. Some people get shy. Others, we see some guests in there. But if you're not logged in, you will not even show up as a guest, and your name will not show up. But you can log in as anything. You could be Moonlight, and you could show up as Moonlight and be able to ask questions of our professor this evening. So I encourage you to, you know, ask anything that you like. And maybe if you know a famous Cuban yourself and you want to know if that person is in the book or if he did any research on that person, go ahead and ask the question, or you can call us here at the station. Let me just flip over to that page really quick. The number here at the station, you can put it up there, Mr. Mann, in the chat so friends can see it. It's 347-843-4717 if you want to call in and ask any questions. We'll go ahead and, you know, open up the mics for you. And so we have the pretty interesting. I love how artistic Cubans are. It seems that the island, even though there's, you know, the repression of speech and repression of, you know, where the regime almost wants to repress even your own thoughts, it hasn't really stopped the Cubans from being able to express themselves in many, many ways. You have also let's jump up to page 23, where we have Néstor Carbonell. Tell us about...
Yeah, Néstor, he's a very good actor. He was born in New York City as well. And as a young boy, he grew up in Venezuela. He attended Harvard University. And after that, he started doing TV roles such as like Resurrection Boulevard, The Tick, Strong Medicine, Cold Case. And he also played the character of, I don't know how many people remember this, he played the character of Luis Rivera on the show Suddenly Susan for 4 seasons. And he also played the role of Richard Alpert for 7 episodes in the 3rd season of Lost. He also appeared as the mayor of Gotham City in Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight, which was a sequel to the 2005 film Batman Begins. Mm-hmm. And he also acted in The Lost City, the movie directed by Andy Garcia. He has won, for example, such awards as the ALMA Awards in 1999, Outstanding Actor in a Comedy Series for Suddenly Susan, and the Star on the Horizon Award, which is the President Award, at the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival in 2003. So here we have a young Cuban guy who went to Harvard, smart guy, who has done very well in the small and the big screen.
You are a professor, and I often hear people saying, oh, so-and-so went to Harvard, so-and-so went to Yale, and they are prestigious colleges. What does it take, and this is off the cuff here, what does it take to get in there?
I think it takes a lot of luck because you have to have a certain GPA to be accepted at Harvard and at Yale, these Ivy League schools. The entry exam is very difficult, but... I did not go to Harvard. I did not go to Yale. I went to St. Thomas University here in Miami, Florida. And good news for the listening audience, the majority of the top CEOs in the United States did not attend the top-tier schools. So take heart to that, folks, that you don't have to have been a graduate of the very famous university in order to succeed.
Yes, repeat that again.
Yes, the majority of the top executives in the United States did not graduate from the top-tier universities. Many of them graduated from middle-level universities. So what really counts is actually is the person and the person's effort and what they learned in school and how do I apply it.
I like what you just said. So the important thing is the person.
Yes, definitely.
What you learned in school and how you apply yourself. Because so many people say, well, but you know, all the people that have all those big wig jobs are white. And, I'm, fair skin or I'm mulatto or I'm black or I'm Indian or whatever it is that I am. And I'm minority and I'm never going to get a chance to have one of those jobs. Is that true?
Well, we have got to get away from this mentality that, I'm Latino, I'm not good enough. Oh, I'm black, I'm not good enough. They're going to discriminate against me. Now, if you have that mindset, you're never going to get any place in the United States. You have got to understand that your brain is God-given to you, and nobody can take that away from you. I'm going to give this scenario. In the United States, because since I live in Miami, I can testify to this. We have had people from the Caribbean, black folks from other island nations, move to the United States, and in a few years, they are better off than their fellow black Americans who were born here, and in many instances, they're better off than white Americans and Latinos. Why? Because they don't have this baggage, this mental baggage that, oh my gosh, they're going to discriminate against me, oh, I'm a loser. No, they come here, they apply themselves, they work, and they succeed. So we got to learn. Let's stop being the victim.
I like stories like that, and sometimes I think that when people have a close-knit family, when they support each other too, I think that helps a lot in succeeding. If there's four of you in the family, but you all stick together and mom and dad help each other and there isn't drug abuse or alcohol abuse or spousal abuse. And because when we have issues, mental, physical or otherwise, then we're throwing different things there. Although there may be families who are struggling and the kids end up succeeding or the woman ends up leaving or however it is, that somehow there's a problem, there's a cancer in the family unit, and the stronger either adult or child seems to cut off from the rest of the family and tends to succeed. It's almost like getting out of this infected cocoon, so to speak, so we can see it. I think you are so right when you say it really is whatever it is in your mind. If you have a strong mind, if you have a strong desire to succeed, you can do it. And the prince is asking, how long did it take you to write this book? How long did it take you to gather the information, the data on these Cubans? Because I know there's more than the ones that you have in the book, correct?
Right. There's a lot more, but I was pressed for time because I said to myself, if I keep on writing, I'll never publish this book. But that's a good question. Since I do work full time, and I love to do research and I love to do reading, Prince, it took me close to a year to do all the research, and then because I'm very meticulous, for example, I do all the research and I write everything down by hand. Then I put it in the computer. That's the way I operate, right? So it took me a long time to condense, to verify, to cross-reference this and that. So it took me about a year to actually do the whole bit, you know? Mm-hmm.
That's not bad when you think about you have a full-time job, and I'm sure that takes a lot of reading as well and research and getting ready for class. What is it that you teach in Miami?
I teach business courses, everything from management to, for example, some of the courses that I teach are small business management, principles of management, introduction to business, introduction to human resources, international business. So I enjoy teaching, and a lot of the stuff that I teach helps me to understand what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And it helps me to understand what we as Americans should do, and perhaps not whine and complain so much when we compare ourselves to other folks, right? And but you know, that's my thing, is to teach and to do research, along as trying to be the best possible husband on this planet.
I am sure you are. Exactly where is it that you teach again?
Yes, I teach in two different places. My full-time job, I am the business lead instructor at a career college called Everest Institute here in Miami, and I've been teaching for about 10 or 11 years at Carlos Albizu University, based here in Doral, Florida. Carlos Albizu University was founded in Puerto Rico many years ago, and then they moved here to have a campus in Miami. I also teach there in their business program.
Neat. So now you folks, if you're in Miami and you're interested in really meeting this wonderful professor and taking some classes from him, you can be up close and personal and learn some knowledge. I think I don't even have to be in your class. I just know you're a great teacher. I love
Thank
listening
you.
To you are. I would love it if you would have been. I had some good ones, but I would have loved to have had you as a professor. Now let's jump up to page 58, and I'm going to say a name that a lot of people might recognize, but he has a nickname, and some people are going to say, who is this? But he's famous. I think he's famous almost worldwide. His name is Armando Christian Perez.
Perez, yes. Armando Christian Perez, better known as Pitbull, right? Pitbull.
Pitbull.
Now, I got to confess something, Cubana. Rap is not my bag. But he is a well-known artist, and he appears now, as we Cubans say, hasta en la sopa. He appears in TV commercials. He appears, you're sleeping, and he wakes you up because he's there. I mean, he's all over the planet, right? But he was born in Miami. His background was kind of sad because he actually, his parents separated when he was very young, and he was raised by his mom. Then he spent some time in a foster home in Georgia. He started rapping when he was in high school. And after that, he came back to Miami, and he started becoming well-known. But some of his songs, such as Shake, Feel It, Out of Control, Hit the Floor, and another song, which is the Cuban slang for backside. I think you know what I mean by that.
Yeah.
It starts with a C and ends with an O.
Yeah.
So he became very well-known in the rap community. He also, I don't know if he still has it, but he has been the host of his own Spanish language program on the cable channel Moon 2, titled La Esquina, which is Spanish for the corner. So Pitbull has really taken off, done very, very well. He had a song not too long ago along with Mark Anthony. So those rappers out there, you probably love Pitbull.
Absolutely, and you know, even if you are not into the words or the lyrics, some of the sound, the music, it just some of the lyrics I don't care for, but I like Pitbull. It's terrible. I like Pitbull. I think he's great. He makes me wanna have. If I don't have energy, I just, you know, watch something from Pitbull on YouTube, and he makes me move. And I think
Absolutely. That's what,
isn't that great that he has that effect on elderly? No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, I mean, he's like a rash. He's all over you.
I know.
Once that music gets started, you know, you start moving back and forth, and it takes over your body. Very contagious.
You're so funny. It's true. He's great. So we wish him the best. And, you know, for anybody who's been alone, I can't imagine being in a home for kids with no family, that has got to be, you know, if that doesn't take a toll on your self-esteem, I don't know what would, you know. And here you look at him and you think he's always been on top of the world. So I hope that we take a little bit of, you know, a little bit of heed at that. Sometimes we just have to forget some of these negative things that happen to us in life and just move on and,
exactly.
and realize that every single one of us has a gift from God and try to find out what it is, because God did put something there, and every single one of us has it. We just have to discover it. I think that is the reason why we have life. That is what we have to do in life. Our journey is to find out what that is. Mr. Man, we have a husky that's going insane over here. She's getting happy.
But did you notice that the dog started barking when we talked about pit bull, right?
Pit bull and God.
Yeah, pit bull just got started.
when Mr. Man got home from work. Yes, hello. Hello. She talks. We think that Lola speaks. When she sees Daddy when he comes home from work, she said hello to him I won't go into everything she says, but we are going to tape her at one time or another. We've already thought about it because she's really a special dog. She's beautiful. And we say words and she repeats them, and she almost sounds like she's saying the syllables, like she's trying to repeat what we say. But we just think Lola is so special. And she's so sweet. So anyway, a little side track there from the show. We love our dogs. So I had actually jumped ahead to Pitbull, but then I ended up writing page 53 because I saw Celia Cruz. How could we have a show about Cubans who have immigrated and not talk about Celia Cruz? I never got a chance to meet her. Did you ever meet Celia?
I never got to see her when she was alive, but I did attend the wake that was held in Miami after she passed away. I remember that I made a line of about 3 hours under a hot sun. Thousands of people were lined up to go up to her casket, and it was very moving because the casket was in this big building in downtown Miami, and they were blasting her music continuously. It was more like a celebration because she meant so much to us Cubans, because that lady was, one of her nicknames was, you know, the Queen of Salsa, right? La Reina de la Salsa. But she was also known as La Bandera que Canta, the flag that sings. She was 100% Cuban. She left Cuba, never went back because she was against communism. She never stopped talking about the human rights abuse in Cuba. When her mother died, the Castro government refused her entry as a way of payback. She was not allowed to go see her mother, and her music was banned in the island. So she became a persona non grata. But she came along with her music. She elevated the salsa music, which has its origins in Cuban music, and she became part of a new generation of Latino musicians here, along with Tito Puente, along with Willie Colon, along with Rey Barreto in New York, that they really elevated Latino music into higher levels. And she won many prizes, many Grammys, and she was a wonderful person. Nobody has ever said a bad thing about Celia Cruz, and we were so sad when she passed away. She was really an institution. Beautiful lady.
You know, I couldn't believe, when I'm looking at her birth date, it was 1925, because I remember as a little girl hearing her in Cuba, and then I didn't even know that she was here. In fact, I heard her music. I believe it was my cousin that sent me a CD from Miami, because we don't, at the time, we didn't get any of that stuff here. I think my son was in, my oldest was a teenager, and when I got that CD, I would put it on, at the time I had a van, and I used to put it on in the van and just listen to it and just blasted, and I loved it. I loved going down the freeway listening to Cuban music. So many times I just cried, because the emotions and Willie Chirino, and just listening to the voices, listening to something that was familiar to me, a voice that I had heard when I was little. It's incredible what that does, how art, music, and films, sometimes just paintings of the artwork in the Cuban dime, and I would see that anywhere, or the flag, the Cuban flag. It just evokes such emotions. Why is it that these symbols, and including music, why is it that evokes the emotions that it does in people, that it sometimes makes you choke up with tears and sadness, and other times it's just such a joy? What is that? What is it that we're missing here? What is that emotion when your throat just closes up on you and your heart feels like it's swollen when you hear about Cuba and you hear songs from Celia and you, can you figure that out? Because I'm still trying.
Well, you know, that's a very good observation, though. What I feel, and this is my opinion, in my case, I have never gone back to Cuba. And I'm 60 years old. I left when I was 9 years old. And sometimes a particular smell, mm-hmm. a particular view of something, of a tree, transports me back, for example, to my grandfather's farm.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think, what would have happened to me if I had stayed in Cuba? You know, what would have happened if communism had never taken place, you know? So we are transported back, because I think all of us as human beings, we have this this seed that never dies of eternal memories. So when I think of Cuba, and every day I think of Cuba, somehow I think of Cuba every day. I think about my grandfather, whom I was named after, and me being a small boy riding horses when I was like 6 years old, riding horses, swimming in the rivers with my cousins there. So those memories are everlasting. And we, you know, we yearn, we long for good times. And I think that's why we do that. And I can compare that, for example, to the Jews who suffered so much during the Holocaust, that I am sure that's unforgettable when they think about their ancestors, when they think about their grandparents, their parents, relatives who had died. That never goes away.
You know, my kids often, they know just about when I'm going to say in Cuba. It could be at any time, at any moment. Before I look, they know that look in my face, and they both say, in Cuba.
There's a little joke behind that also. Because do you know the joke about how many Cubans does it take to change a light bulb?
No, I don't.
Well, it takes three. It takes two to hold the ladder, and the third to say that the light bulbs in Cuba were better. So that's a little Cuban humor there for you.
Well, it very well could be, because you know, you can't do things alone. Cubans, they all do it. They get together and they have to do things in groups, you know, help each other out. But it is so true. My kids, they make fun of me, because I often talk about it, and I think I dramatize and I exaggerate things. But I do it to make a point. I think that in a way I'm a little bit of a storyteller myself, and I don't even know it. But I'm trying to make my kids remember. Because I know that I'm not going to live forever, and so when I'm gone, I want them. You know, I exaggerate all the time when it comes to Cuba, and it is to make that point. But my kids know the difference, that they know that I'm exaggerating. And I let them know exactly what the truth is. Let's jump. There are so many good people here, and I want a chance.
Let me interject something here before I forget.
Yes.
You know, Celia's trademark, her slogan was azúcar, right? Which means sugar.
Yes.
She always said azúcar. Now, do you know the reason behind why she said azúcar? Have you any idea?
No, I never even thought about it.
Yeah. She related at one time during an interview that she had come to Miami years ago, and she was having lunch, I think it was, at a Cuban restaurant. Then the waiter came and says, you want some Cuban coffee? And she said, of course. And then the guy says, with sugar or no sugar? And then she looked at the waiter and she told him, hey, I'm Cuban. Of course with azúcar. So that, in her mind, the next time she had a concert, she relayed that story to the audience. And from then on, she says, I'm going to stick with azúcar. That's the reason why she used the term azúcar, because of the restaurant.
Right. I never knew that story, but I love the way she said it. Nobody could say it like her. I don't know if Prince Emmanuel ever met her, being down there in Miami, and I know he says he has a Kwanzaa event coming up December 29th, just before the end of the year, and you guys can become his friend there. You can link. We're going to go ahead and link him up. We'll check out your fan page after the show, because we can't click on there now. And then we'll go ahead and link it to this ad on the show on CubanaRama.com, so people know and they can come to your event for Kwanzaa. And that's what Cubans do. We love everything. We love Christmas. We love Kwanzaa, right?
Everything. As long as it's a party, we're there.
Yeah, party and bring the drums, right? Because we love that. Let's jump up to page 80, and he's going to tell us where it's going to be, at the African Heritage Cultural Arts Center. So go ahead and put the address there, Prince Emmanuel. Thank you. And I'll go ahead and read it before the show is over. But let's jump to Doctor, because I thought this guy is really, really, really important is the word. Important and intelligent. On page 80, you have a doctor, and his name is Dr. Pedro Sanchez. Pedro Sanchez, he made an impact on international agriculture. How did this guy do that?
Well, this guy, he was born in Cuba, and his family had a farm. So he was always interested how his dad was working with the farmers in Cuba to try to increase productivity of the crops. Yeah. So this sparked an interest in him to study. So he actually came to the United States and started his studies at Cornell University in 1958. So his thing was to study agriculture. Now, when the communist regime took over, his father didn't have any money for him to continue studying in Cornell. So he had to, do without any money. So what did he do, as any good immigrant does? He pulled himself by his bootstraps. He got himself a job. He worked. He persevered. He worked, and he studied. And he got degrees in agronomy and in social science. So by 1968, he became a Ph.D. Now, this is the importance of this man, of Dr. Pedro Sanchez. He is the 2002 World Food Prize laureate, and he has been decorated by the governments of Colombia and Peru. He has won the MacArthur Foundation's prestigious Genius Award in honor of his numerous achievements in expanding food supplies and improving ecological conditions in developing countries and the world. And check this out. He was also named Hero of Humanity by Haifa International World Ark publication in 2006. Because he is able to help farmers all over the world to increase their capacity for greater crop production. He did this in Brazil, where through the methods that he implemented and suggested, the average yields increased by 60%. Total grain tripled, and Brazilian soybean production grew to match that of the United States. So this man was such an impact in Africa that Africa was just devastated by different droughts, that he was able to adopt his method, that they increased their yields by as much as 400%, And the people in Africa honored him. As a matter of fact, in 2001, the leader of Western Kenya's Luo community made Dr. Sanchez an honorary elder because for the first time in living memory, the people in that village no longer went to sleep hungry. So we're very proud of this Cuban named Pedro Sanchez, who has helped humanity due to hunger. He's helped them to feed themselves.
Now, when I think of him, and I think of Cuba, and I think of all the people around the world who are going to bed hungry, I can't not just get angry at politicians who say we need to raise taxes, or we need to do this, or we need to do that, or we need to make more programs. What we need is entrepreneurial brains that help people be self-sufficient. This is a very great example for anybody who wants to sit and depend on the government to feed you, to give you anything. Here is a guy who did it all by himself, and he's teaching people how to eat, how to grow it so that you can be self-sufficient, so that you don't have to depend on a shipment coming from another country. Anywhere in the world, he can teach people how to grow. What, do you know what is the secret? How does he do it?
Well, because he studied here and he uses his God-given talent, he was able to give the farmers ideas of different crop rotation, different methods how to fertilize the land. It's a complex system, but they put it into use in very arid situations, in very drought-stricken areas, and these people produce so much food that they were able to sustain themselves and actually export and make money, so it was a win-win situation. Now, what bothers me, Cubana, is that a person like Dr. Pedro Sanchez is America's gain and Cuba's loss, correct?
Yes.
If he had stayed in Cuba, for example, he could have revolutionized crop growth, crop yields in Cuba as well. But communism, which is a system that's really, it's a terrible system, drives the best people out. This is what we call brain drain, right? A little story. I was a little boy, maybe, 8 years old, and in my backyard in my hometown, one day I decided I wanted to become a farmer. And I planted some beans in my backyard. And then my mom told me, well, you have to water every day. So I water my little beans, and they grew and they grew. And then one day my mom says, it's time for you to pick the beans. I remember I collected all those beans. I brought them inside the house. I washed them out. My mother cooked them. And then I had a really nice potaje. I had a nice stew of the beans that I had planted. Now, why do I bring this story? Because in 61 or 62, up until the moment that you and I are speaking, Cubana, Cuba is one of two countries in the entire world that its population has a food rationing card. People have to have a little card to go to Cuba to a store, and with this little card, they are given a certain amount of food per month that lasts maybe 2 weeks. If I was a little boy and I planted stuff in my backyard and it yielded me beans, Cuba has fertile land, very good fertile land, and they still need food rationing, there's something wrong with the system, not the people.
Well, and that's what the government does when they feed you. They want to tell you how much you can eat and how much you need. And they don't. It's never going to be. They never give you enough. Just like Social Security, they used it all up, and Medicaid and Medicare, and they keep taking more and taking more until there is just nothing left. And when there is nothing left, and people think that they have any rights, they will tell you have no rights because there's nothing more to give. People have no rights in Cuba. There's just nothing to give. They have nothing to give you. And they definitely don't want you to have the freedom. I don't understand why it's all power. I mean, I don't have to understand it anymore. It used to drive me insane. I just, it doesn't matter why they do it. The fact that they do it, there's just such a cynicism in the government. And for them to act like they are totally anti, they're anti-Americans because we consume and they don't like the capitalist idea, but they are the biggest capitalists themselves. I mean, Castro has millions and millions of dollars in foreign banks, and they live very lavishly with the best caviar and wine and cigars and, you know, and vehicles. And so we know that these guys up there who say that they want, you know, to help the poor people of America or, you know, the poor people of any country, we know the government doesn't want to help anybody. What they want to do is take your money, and the more money they have, the better off they are. They're like those, you know, it's like the hungry beast who's never, never satisfied. That's my little spiel.
It's okay.
It makes me so angry when I see the injustices, because you know that there is absolutely no reason for anybody to go to bed hungry, cold, or, you know, lonely. There's just plenty of love and help to go around, and there's a lot of people who are willing to do it. In many countries, especially the United States, we in the United States are people who are very, we are giving people, and we go to other countries, and there's all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of pastors and programs where people, out of their, you know, out of their own, out of their, the goodness of their own heart, they want to go and help, and they do it. But all these other countries put all these, you know, things in place. It just makes it difficult. It makes it really, really hard. And then most of us, when we do send money or we do send packages, it's like, for example, with Haiti, there's all those millions of dollars that they collected, and for a fact, that money never went to the people who needed it, and the government used it to pay off their debt. That is what I'm hearing. So if anybody knows anything different, go ahead and email me and let me know. But that is what I'm hearing that they did with all the millions of dollars. So it is pitiful. There's an anthropologist, and I love the word anthropologist. I love dirt. I love digging things and finding treasures. This lady, Lydia Cabrera, from the 1800s, and a poet. Imagine that. Anthropologist and a poet. Why did you choose her? What is so interesting about this woman in 1800s, 1899 to 1991?
Yeah, she lived actually a very, very long life. She died here in Miami. And she was one of the first people that actually studied in a serious manner, in a very documented manner, the Cuban Afro-Cuban culture. She was introduced to Afro-Cuban culture when she was a young lady, and as you say, interesting lady, anthropologist and poet. What a combination, right? That's
right.
Interesting. She we have to realize that, you know, Cuba was not a backward country. Why do I say this? I mean, she went to study in France, you know. She went to study in France in 1927.
Wow.
And she graduated from school in France in 1930. She went back to Cuba, and she left in 1960 after the communists took over. But basically, she was an authority on Santeria. And for those of you who probably, it may ring a bell, Santeria is, you know, Afro-Cuban religion, right? So she was an authority on Santeria and other Afro-Cuban religions. She published over 100 books regarding that aspect of Cuban culture. But unfortunately, very little is available in English. Her most famous work, best known work, is El Monte, which is the wilderness. In that particular work, that's the first major anthropological study of Afro-Cuban traditions. So after she passed away, she donated her entire collection of research to the University of Miami. So she was very well-known, very quiet lady, but she was a treasure of knowledge. Very, very well-known. If anybody wants to read about Santeria, She was the figure. She was the person who was really an authority.
That is so neat. I wish some of these people were alive, and I wish that I was able to interview them because I'm so interested in the culture, the Santeria culture. Why is it that some Cubans love it, white Cubans, and they have embraced it, and others are afraid of it? Do you know?
Well, it's, you know, normally we human beings, we are afraid of the unknown, right? If we don't know something, we're not aware of it, we're ignorant of something, we're usually afraid of it. It's a natural tendency. But I think it's because we're kind of biased that anything that's relating to Santeria, voodoo, it is so foreign to us that we think it's the devil's work, so we shy away from that. But in Miami, it's people who become santeros, they dress in white. And you can tell people who are santeros when they dress completely in white. They got all kinds of beard, not beard, like hair, facial, beads. They have beads in their around their neck and by their wrist. And it could be like a little kid and the father and mother, they all dress in white. They're undergoing the process of becoming santeros. And then they have their padrino, their godfather, who is their initiator, and tells them what they need to do, sacrifices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there was a famous case here years ago where there is a Santeria church, Lukumi church here, that they were sacrificing animals as part of their religious tradition, and the city of Hialeah wanted to shut them down because of animal abuse. This thing went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said these people have the right to practice their religion, and they're going to be allowed to sacrifice animals. And apparently, you know, the animals are supposedly well taken care of, they're well fed, they're in nice clean cages, and when their moment comes to be sacrificed, you know, they're killed like quickly, and then they're eaten, you know, they're eaten. So it's one of these situations where a lot of people are hush-hush, but they may be believers, but they don't divulge it.
Okay. My father loved it. My father loved the Santeria, and I went to a lot of seances when I was a kid. So I enjoyed. I never saw any animals being sacrificed, so that part of the religion I never saw, but I did see the seances, and the seances were really, really an amazing. I mean, I loved it, whether it was true or not true. Some people say all these people are fakes. I don't know if they were fakes or not fakes, but I saw a lot of things that made me a believer at that age, and still things that are unexplainable that happened. So I have a lot of respect for everyone's religion. The smell, I love the smell of flowers. That was one of the things that I remember the most, is how many flowers they had. There's a few others that I have chosen, but I'm going to say one more and then give you a chance to you and I are going to have to get together again.
I know, it's a lot of stuff to cover.
Oh, I can't believe it. But there's another guy, Carlos Eire.
Oh, yes, Carlos Eire. Carlos Eire, he's also a Pedro Pan.
Oh.
He came in the same situation as I was. He's a very well-known professor at Yale University.
Wow.
So he's up there in an Ivy League area of Connecticut. And I'm just looking up here, Carlos, 88. Okay, now I got it over here.
89.
Now,
and you know, the
right.
Interesting thing is that I went to a bookstore here in Minneapolis, and I saw this book once called Waiting for Snow in Havana. And here I live in Minnesota, and I my God, I have to have this book. And I bought it. I started reading it, but I have so many other books that I, you know, in between doing the show and stuff, that I haven't been able to finish it. But the beginning of the book is very, very intriguing. I suggest that if you are interested in great, great book, Waiting for Snow in Havana. Yes, tell me about him. Who is this guy?
Well, he was... He came from a well-to-do family in Cuba. He and his brother came to the United States via Operation Pedro Pan. He came to Miami. He lived with a foster home, actually a Jewish couple that really took care of him quite well. And he attended the same elementary school that my children went to.
Wow.
And he actually grew up like two blocks away from where I used to live here in Miami. So it's a small world. And then he went to Chicago. He studied there. And he's right now, he's what is known as the T. Lawrence Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University. He has authored quite a few books on religion and history. But his book, Waiting for Snow in Havana, actually won the National Book Award in Nonfiction in 2003. So he's a very good writer. He also wrote another one that I also read. I believe it's called Waiting to Die in Miami.
Oh.
We got Waiting for Snow in Havana and Waiting to Die in Miami. So Waiting for Snow in Havana talks about his life in pre-Castro. He has a very good memory because he's able to relate a lot of his personal history. Unlike myself, I don't have that many memories. To be honest with you, I think I have suppressed a lot of memories, but I'm not a psychiatrist. But anyway, one thing happened to him that created some type of controversy years ago. When Fidel Castro became sick a few years ago and he relinquished power, the New York Times actually approached Carlos Eide and wanted him to write an article critical of the Cuban American community in Miami, because when the news hit here that Castro was sick, people really got happy. They started dancing in the street and they said, "This guy's on his way out, so we're happy." The New York Times actually wanted him to write an article criticizing the Cuban Americans for that type of behavior.
Oh, wow.
But Carlos Eide says, "The heck with you. I'm not writing an article criticizing the Cubans in Miami. I understand what they're going to. I'm not going to write an article like you want me to." So this created a big stink of the New York Times wanting to sort of more or less use a Cuban American from Ivy League school to maybe, you know, downgrade Cuban Americans. But, you know, as we say, el tiro le salió por la culata. You know, things did not turn out the way they wanted to. He's a tough cookie. Carlos Eide is a tough cookie.
I love it when a person has integrity. I love it. I love it when you can't buy them. You can't.
Yeah,
make...
exactly. Exactly.
It sounds like he's a really neat guy. Well, tell me, I feel like I chose all the, you know, I had chosen so many, but I can't believe the time, because we did spend quite a bit of time talking in the beginning about Cuba, the basis of it. But you and I, like I said, we're going to have to meet again and do this and talk about a few more, because it's so interesting.
Sure.
To want to hear a little bit more about it. But tell me, who did you pick to tell me about this evening?
Okay. The one person that I can speak for a few minutes before we finish has been the most successful Cuban-American business person ever.
Uh-huh.
Roberto Goizueta, who was the CEO of Coca-Cola.
Yes, that was one of my choices, too. I'm glad you're mentioning him.
Yeah. Actually, Roberto Goizueta, he was born in 1931 in Havana. He mm-hmm. died in 1997 here in the United States. And he started, actually, very interesting background. His parents had a sugar refinery business in Cuba. And he actually studied. He came to the United States as a teenager, and he spent 1 year at a prep school in Connecticut to sharpen up his English skills. He went back to Cuba. He finished his education there, high school education. Then he graduated from Yale University in 1948. He earned a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering. So we're talking about a sharp person here. Mm-hmm. And once he graduated in 1953, he returned to Cuba. And he started working his family business there. But he wasn't really into his family business. So he actually applied to an anonymous ad that he saw in the newspaper. They were looking for a bilingual person to work at a Coca-Cola bottler. So he applied and he got hired. Now, shortly thereafter, he was promoted to chief technical director of 5 Cuban bottling plants. Okay, so he was on his way up. Now, Castro came in, took power, obviously, took everything over, and he had to leave the United States, for the United States, with about $40 and about 100 shares of Coca-Cola. He started working for Coca-Cola here in Miami. Then he was assigned to the Bahamas as a chemist. Then in 1964, he was moved to the headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia. And this is how smart and brilliant this man was, Cubana. When he was 35 years old, he became vice president of technical research and development. He remains to this day the youngest person to hold this position at that company, all right, at 35 years of age. And in 1975, he was promoted to lead the legal and external affairs department. He kept moving up. In 1979, he was chosen to become president of the Coca-Cola company. And then the officer, the then officer at that time, resigned. So in 1981, he assumed the chairmanship after the chairman retired. Now, the thing about Roberto Goizueta is that under his leadership, Coca-Cola became the most widely known trademark in the world. He was the person that introduced the slogan such as Coke is it,
uh-huh.
Can't beat the feeling, always Coca-Cola. He also launched Diet Coke, as well as the not-so successful New Coke, all right? So he was behind the New Coke as well. Those of us who remember, it was launched. There was almost a revolution in the streets of America because people said, where's my regular Coke? I don't want this new Coke.
Right.
And they had to reintroduce it as Classic Coke, remember? The Classic Coke. So that was his one thing that perhaps did not go so well for him. But under his leadership, the thing about him is that he brought tremendous value to stockholders, okay? Now, just to give you an idea, under the leadership of Roberto Goizueta, the price of stock in Coca-Cola increased by 3,500%. It's not a mistake, 3,500%, and the company tripled in size. Diet Coke became the most popular soft drink in the world and the third most preferred behind regular Coke and Pepsi-Cola. He was also a visionary because he was always looking ahead. He was looking towards, like, open new markets, new opportunities. And this happened when the Berlin Wall fell back in 1989. He was already ready to launch Coca-Cola in Eastern Europe. As a matter of fact, in 3 years, Coca-Cola became the favorite European soft drink over Pepsi. And in 1996, Chief Executive Magazine named him Chief Executive of the Year, and Fortune Magazine recognized the Coca-Cola Company as America's most admired corporation. Now, when he died back in 87, Coca-Cola has not even come close to reaching the financial success it enjoyed under him, under Goizueta. A side note, he was also a dog lover, which is something I'm sure you're going to enjoy. He was a dog lover. Even as a young man, he was certified as a show judge for the boxer breed, and he had a champion. His champion, Pembroke Welsh Gorky show dog, whose name was Fizz, won best of breed at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show in 1996 and 1997. So Roberto Goizueta, to be honest with you, when they were thinking of promoting him, there were some people who did not want this Latino guy taking over Coca-Cola because this was an American company, and they wanted, by God, they wanted an American, okay, right there. I'm looking at something here that I have to add because this man was great as a businessman. This is from a book review about the life and leadership of Coca-Cola's Roberto Goizueta, where it says here that Coke's profits grew fourfold during his 17-year tenure between 1980 and 1997 and enabled Coke's stock price to grow at a 25% compounded rate, more than double the appreciation of his chief competitor PepsiCo, and quintupled that of the Standard & Poor's 500 index. So not only did he make himself a ton of money, he was able to buy a bunch of Cokes, right? But the shareholders were also able to enjoy and reap the benefits of his great mastery, and people were able to have more jobs because he tripled the size of Coca-Cola. So to us, we're very proud that a Cuban American led, as CEO and chief financial officer, Coca-Cola Corporation.
Yeah, and isn't it funny? I told you I was when I was a little girl, I went to my backyard after communism had hit, and there was no Coca-Cola in my Coca-Cola bottle.
Yeah, I remember that. That's just terrible.
I know. So that's probably, you know, here we are so many years later, and he was already in the United States on his way to move up into the, and here I was. What a, you know, coincidences in life. And I knew I was going to talk about him, but I didn't make the connection when I said it, and I hadn't even planned on saying what I said about myself. Interesting man, very intelligent, board of directors, as you said, of various companies, of a bank, SunTrust Bank, the Ford Motor Company, which has a base here in Minneapolis or St. Paul. I don't know if they still do. And the Eastman Kodak Company. And so he sounds like he was everywhere. He sounds like a, like you said, very, very intelligent man. And these are the people that Castro is, you know, doing without. Cuba could be, this is the reason. Why is it, this is the reason, and I'm going to ask you, why is it that Cuba has so many intelligent Cubans?
I don't know. You know, we have been called, and when I say we, I mean we Cuban Americans, we have been called the Caribbean Jews, because we know that the Jewish population, the Jewish group, wherever they go, they succeed. Why? Because right. They're hard workers. They become educated. They forge ahead. No obstacle is too big to overcome. So, I mean, I'm proud. If people say, you Cubans, you're like the Caribbean Jews, I'm proud to be called that, because I'm proud of the Jewish people and what the Jewish people have accomplished in the United States, and wherever they set foot, they always, you know, forge ahead and they become very productive citizens. So to us, I think it's just a mental attitude, an inclination to succeed, because one thing, Cubana, is that Cuba was an independent country for only 57 years. Because
wow.
In 1902, Cuba became independent, right? Before that, it was a colony of Spain. So Cuba was an independent country from 1902 to 1959 when communism took over. So in those 57 years, Cuba did tremendous progress. Again, I realized there was corruption. There was, you know, all kinds of wheeling and dealing, whatever you want to call it. But aside from that, the country stepped ahead big time, big time. Now, before I forget, those folks out there who are listening, who may be interested in the book, The Cubans, Our Legacy in the United States, it's available only online through maybe, you know, obviously through Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble. One thing, if you want to reach me, those folks who may be interested perhaps in getting a signed copy, I have some copies still with me. You can get a hold of me through Facebook, or you can reach me at my personal email, which is Fernpa, F-E-R-N-P-A, again, F-E-R-P-A at hotmail.com, and we can work something out that I can sign it for you and send it to you.
That's wonderful, and Christmas is coming up, so people out there, if you have a friend or a relative or mom, dad, grandpas, anybody who can speak English, you have the book in Spanish as well?
No, it's available right now only in English, and it is available in Kindle for those people who have Kindle.
Great. So we're going to go ahead and put a link, Mr. Mann. Make sure that link is correct, because I think it's incorrect on the webpage, so people can get to it in directly. Just before we go on the air, don't leave me, because go ahead and download the show. We're going to probably stay with Fernando for a few more minutes. But I want to remind you guys, Kwanzaa, African Heritage Cultural Arts Center, 6161 Northwest 22nd Avenue in Miami. And he is going to be performing, was it December 29th? That was there in the on the page. We're going to go ahead and post that also on the webpage. I believe it was December 29th. I saw that, if I saw that correctly. And that is, again, the African Heritage Cultural Arts Center, 6161 Northwest 22nd Avenue in Miami. Prince Emmanuel, he's an artist, painter, musician, you name it, you'll love to see him. And the book, again, Fernando Hernandez, The Cubans, Our Legacy in the United States. Wow. Well, if you were to give us advice, you teach business, what is the thing that we need today to have that entrepreneurial spirit to succeed, for not just for Cubans but for everybody, all Americans?
Well, what I would suggest is really get involved with the latest technology. Because more and more businesses is being conducted through Facebook, Twitter, so we have got to be on top of the technology game. That, and also try to provide the best possible customer service that you can. Because don't try to compete on price. Because people will go shopping at an expensive place because they see value. So try to give people either great value with very good customer service, and then you will succeed. Don't think about profit. Profit will be a consequence of you doing the right thing. If you go into business just thinking of making money, you're going to fail. Profit is a side effect or a consequence of you doing great service, having a good product, or having a service for people along with good customer service for your clients. That's my best tip that I can offer in a couple of minutes.
Now, they used to say location, location, location. Is that?
Yes. Yes, real estate. Yes, location, location, location. That helps also. But I have seen restaurants here in Miami that are hole in the walls, hard to find, and they're always full. Why is that? Because they got really good food, and they got really good service, and the prices are very affordable, and people are willing to wait an hour and a half to have dinner there. So, you got to have a good product.
Basically,
you got to have a good product.
I love it. Well, thank you. Okay, before I, just one more question. Are you going to write a sequel to this book?
I'm thinking about it because I have a lot of information that I have compiled that is worthy of me to write a sequel. I have to, because there are many good people that should be told about their life story as well. Mm-hmm.
You know, I hope that that if you do, that you would consider writing about a dear friend that just passed away, December 9th. He was the producer of the Macarena. You remember that song, the Macarena?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Can you believe
it? Mike Try. Mike in the Night.
Yes, Mike in the Night, and he, what a dear friend. And, it saddens me that I spoke with him many, many hours. I spent a lot of the last few months, really this last year, we got to know each other. I've known him since 2009, but the last few months, the last year, we became very close, and we had planned on doing a lot of really cool things together. And he dies unexpectedly, and it was such a shock for myself and the people in Florida. But one of the things that I feel that I feel like he never really got the recognition that he deserved for all the things that he did for people, and he helped so many people. So he would be somebody to consider as
sure.
born of Cuban mom and dad, and learn about his father, because his father was very instrumental. He was a really neat guy. Moved to Puerto Rico, and Mike was born in Puerto Rico, but he spoke. He always told me, you know, I'm Puerto Rican, but I'm very much a Cuban also. I hear all the stories that my dad said, and he was saddened about what had happened to our culture and the fact that I don't think his father ever went back either. So many conversations. I wish he was alive. Miss him dearly. But anyway, I had a ball with you tonight, this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming to the show, Fernando Hernandez. The Cubans, our legacy in the United States, makes me feel proud that somebody would even take the time to write about our heritage and to remind ourselves and show the world that, you know, we are contributing. We didn't just come here to take. We came here to give and to leave behind a historical value and economic value and knowledge value to this country, this wonderful country of America that gave us our second home. Thank you so much. Do you have anything else to say in parting, Fernando?
Well, I want to thank you for this invitation, and I want to thank the listening audience for your support and for listening to our program. I hope it has been educational, it has been interesting, it has been entertaining. And I hope that in the near future we can have another program. We can talk about other folks in the book as well.
Absolutely. I look forward to doing that. And folks, if you love this show, go ahead and send a copy to your friends. It's free. It doesn't cost anything. So help us out. Share the word. And have a wonderful evening. Guess what? Next, I won't be having another show. I'm going to take a few days off, and I will be back. I believe it's the 28th. It's a Friday. We are going to be talking to a really neat guy. Check it out on my website. Anything that comes up, because, you know, from time to time, I may not have a show planned, but if somebody calls me and I get that burning desire that I have to get on the radio because I have to do this and I really can squeeze it in, I do. So go ahead and keep checking back on the website on Friday the 28th. Really, really interesting show with a really interesting man. Read all about him. We're going to be talking about the shooting at the school, at the Connecticut school. We're going to talk about, you know, weapons. We're going to talk about what can we do? Why did it happen? He is a retired chief of police of New York City, and I want to know exactly if he knows what the timeline on these things were. There is so much discrepancy in the news. I don't like it. That's the reason why I haven't even watched television on this particular issue. I've been doing a lot of reading, but no TV. I held back because I do not want my brain tainted with a lot of different information. So I'm going to really enjoy that interview and figure out what can we do to help parents and help teachers and help law enforcement and, you know, anybody out there who needs to be on the lookout, recognizing issues with kids or even issues with anybody when people go a little bit haywire out there in public. What can we do to protect ourselves? So I hope you guys tune into that show. It'll be very informational. Last night I had a show with an attorney from Florida, from Miami, and he was very, very good. Dennis Gonzalez, I hope you guys, if you didn't tune into that show, you can still go ahead and download it. It'll be up there indefinitely, so share it with your friends. A lot of information about the law and what your rights are now that the holiday season is coming up. I hope you guys are not drinking and driving, but God forbid if you have one too many and you get arrested or you get stopped, there's information there as to what your rights are, and I hope you don't do it again because we want everybody to be healthy and alive and follow the law. And with that said, big hug to you. We love you, Fernandez.
Thank you. Thank you,
Spencer, for being on the show. And we look forward to seeing you again. Have a wonderful Christmas. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you, your family, and all of Miami, New York, and my friends all over the world who listen to Cubanorama. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Have a wonderful evening. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Man. Play it. Oh.